Mask on. Okay. All right. Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and start the True Commission meeting. We'll call it to order at 4:04 p.m. We have the approval that have everybody looked over. I think you guys have. Do we have approval of the minutes from September 9th, 2021?
Move approval of the minutes.
Second. Submitted.
Thank you. Okay, so we have the this afternoon, we have the presentation of Mr. Sheriff Mike Williams, question and answer. We may commence with that, sir. Thank you for coming.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We have millions of questions, but we'll get started.
Great. So I, a couple of quick comments, and then we could jump right into the questions. So, you know, one of the things that we've been focusing on in the last few years, and this relates to the questions, is really the building some additional technology base to help us in fighting crime in the community. And we've been able to do that, and I know ShotSpotter is one of the questions. I'll talk about that in just a second. But that is a piece of a larger puzzle that we've been putting together the last couple of years. A lot of focus and effort on that. A lot of focus and effort on adding police officers to the force. And so, you know, when we talk about having the right number of policemen in the right place at the right time, doing the right things with the right tools, I mean, all that's important. And so we've leveraged a couple of different conversations, I guess, over the last couple of years, the best way to do it, to add those new officers to the force while continuing to really battle a massive wave of attrition because of retirements. The best example I can give you is that as I stand here today, we have 1,827 police officers in the agency. I've hired about 1,400 of those since I've been sheriff. So an incredibly young workforce, lots of turnover. Nobody left for any other reason other than it was time for them to leave. Their retirement time had come. So we were an older organization, and we've just become a very young organization in a very short period of time. So a lot of leadership challenges there, a lot of day-to-day challenges there that we have a great team working on, and we'll continue to focus on that. And then really a theme through the entire last 6 years has been getting the community engaged in what we're doing and what we're trying to do. And we've been successful in doing that somewhat. And this, actually, 2020 was a big focus year for us to really focus in on how do we let the community know more about what we're doing. How do we get them more engaged in working with us? COVID set that back just a little bit, as you can imagine. That's been a huge challenge for us, by the way, especially in the jail, the correctional environment. But being back on track end of last year, first of this year again, we want to continue in that vein. So I think from a technology standpoint, we have some additional things that we're finishing. We won't have any more big technology projects in the agency in the next year and a half. We'll continue to kind of evaluate where we are in terms of the number of police officers. And so we'll always have those conversations with the mayor and the council about where we think we should be there. And then, as always, from day one till the last day, continuing to really work to educate the community, working with the community on, you know, how we can work together. And really, that model is a success. One of the only things you can say in law enforcement, because it's different in every part of the country and it's different agency to agency, but one of the common themes of agencies that are successful and have success in driving down crime in communities is that they have a good working relationship with the community. And so, you know, we know that to be true and again, work on that every single day. So with that, I'll be glad to dive into to the questions that you guys have. Yes, ma'am.
I'll go first, sir. So when you said working with the community, which I think is, you know, is very important.
Absolutely.
So I apologize, mask. So what are some things you guys are working at doing as far as to, you know, getting a relationship with in the community?
Sure. So I'm going to look at my phone for a minute because we just had a list that we put together. As you can imagine, we've got a lot of things working in a lot of different parts of the agency, and I'll read this list to you. So, and all of these things do something a little bit different. Obviously, Police Athletic League is a flagship for us in terms of reaching young people in the community. You've got about 4,500 kids a year that through sports, after-school programs, and summer programs that we're able to interact with, and we think that's a huge benefit. We have One Cop, which is a community outreach a program that we have that really focuses on faith-based organizations in the community. And so Sheriff's Watch is really our flagship program. We have 20 Sheriff's Watches around the city They meet once a month with the policemen that work in their neighborhoods and their supervisors and their zone commanders, and they talk about what's important to their neighborhoods, not just, you know, what's happening big city, big picture, but what happened around the corner from your house or what's going on at this house, that type of thing. So, and it's a great way where we work back and forth with the community on a consistent basis. A lot of great projects working with Operation Save Our Sons. We spend a lot of time working with that organization, and they do great work. We have a project that we are currently, I think we're on year two. We may have finished year two already with Bethune-Cookman University. So it is a community engagement facilitation project with them. So they really will bring a group of citizens in the community together. They'll have a conversation about law enforcement with that group of citizens, and then they'll bring a group of officers together. We've been doing it by zone, and so we're about four zones in now. They'll bring a group of officers from a particular zone in and talk about community perceptions of law enforcement in that particular area, and then they bring those groups together at the end. And mind you, the groups are the officers and those citizens are in the areas where they work together. So that's been a tremendous project for us. I mean, we've really had some great benefits from that. And I'll go briefly with some of these others. Bridging the Gap is another program that we've been doing in partnership with the school board, Operation Save Our Sons. We focused on Ed White High School, but we're partnering, taking young men and really focusing on kind of a grassroots interaction. There's not a lot of presentation. There's not a lot of fluff and circumstance in it. It's just getting people together to talk. And so it's been a hugely successful program. I think you'll see John Guns is a friend and has done a lot of work with us, and we're having conversations about taking this project statewide or maybe even nationally. So tremendous benefits from that program. And then I'll run through the rest of these quickly. The Police Explorers program, young people getting engaged in law enforcement type training, really exposing them to law enforcement again as a recruiting tool more than anything else. We use that heavily. The Citizens Academy. I leave here tonight. When I leave here, I'm going to speak to the Citizens Academy. We have now we do two of those a year. So it's, you know, you sign up, you spend 12 Thursdays over the course of a couple months looking at different parts of the organization, having presentations come in. And again, a great way to interact with the community and let them, you know, have a visual on what we're doing. We partnered with the Florida Sheriff's Association on a project called Harmony in the Streets, where they come to, we focused on our local housing projects, and they come and, in conjunction with PAL, come and do some summer outreach programs for young people in the community. Coffee with a Cop is a great one that we do in conjunction with McDonald's. Haircuts and Conversations is one we do. We go to barbershops and have pretty candid, frank conversations about big issues in the community. And then community walks, which have been sidelined a bit, as you can imagine, because of COVID. But when I first came into office, you know, Sheriff Glover started doing walks in the community, you know, 20-plus years ago now. Sheriff Rutherford kept that up. So certainly it was nothing I was going to change coming in and knew I wanted to keep that in place. But I quickly realized, look, it's great for me to walk, and I still do. But it's even better for the chiefs and the lieutenants and the sergeants and the officers to get out and knock on a door and meet the people that work in their neighborhood. Not the people that are causing a problem they have to interact with, or not, you know, not responding to a law enforcement issue, but just to have you hear a lot of people talking about, I'd love for an officer to have time to just stop and talk to me in my neighborhood. Because of volume and staffing issues, we really don't have the ability to do that as much as we would like to. So we have to create that time, and those walks were a way for us to do that. So we've done about 1,500-plus walks in the community since I've been sheriff, and it's at every level. And I tell people all the time, I mean, when you knock on somebody's door and they, you know, they want to have a conversation, and we start with, how's the neighborhood and how can we help? And they'll tell you quickly, mm-hmm. Here's what we need, here's what mm-hmm. we think you should do, and here's, you know, and it's great feedback. And so that's a program that, while again, COVID has sidelined that a bit, is not gonna stop. We're gonna continue to do that work. So that's kind of a snapshot mm-hmm. of that's over a dozen things that we are actively engaged in today, and there's been many other programs that we do sporadically and periodically, but those are really the core, probably, you know, 12 to 14 programs that we focus on, you know.
Another question would be, why do you think, I guess I'll refer to my community because I live in the north side. Mm-hmm. Why is it, it seems like, you know, when the crime is, have occurred and, you know, against, you know, no one's talking, what have you. I mean, what is it about the relationship that they're, you know, not giving the information about what has happened, what have you? I mean, what can we do about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, some of that is, some of that's more narrative than actual fact. I mean, so
okay.
We don't solve any crimes without the community's engagement.
Okay.
Without
cool.
their involvement. Okay. So, the best example I can give you, if I have a shooting that happens in a neighborhood on the north side, we'll have lots of people call.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people, some of it anonymous,
okay.
but lots of people step forward and say, hey, here's what I saw. If you have a shooting happen in a club at 2:00 in the morning, you may have 300 people in there and nobody saw anything. So it's really about the group, not so much as the area of town.
Okay.
If you get people involved in that gang, gun, drug culture,
mm-hmm.
They really don't want to cooperate. They do sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It happens
mm-hmm.
More frequently than people think. But at the end of the day, it's really about, it's not so much the demographic or the neighborhood. It's just about the environment that people are in when those crimes occur. So we get a lot of great support from the community, a lot of calls. I mean, those tips help us solve crimes in the community, and especially the last couple of years, we've done a really good job at being able to solve some of those high-profile crimes in the community because of, you know, tips and interactions with citizens.
And will you guys ever, because I remember they had the substations under Ned Glover, Sheriff Ned Glover, years ago. Will you guys ever, you know, bring that back out again? Because it seemed like it worked.
Stop stations, you mean?
I thought it was substation, whatever.
Yeah, substations we have still. So we have 6 zones. There's a main substation in every zone. So we're decentralized in terms of the officers.
Mm-hmm.
So if you work in Arlington, you go to work in Arlington every day.
Mm-hmm.
You don't come to downtown and then go to Arlington. So you work in that community. The stop stations were the little places where you could go have a cup of coffee or use the restroom or that type of thing. There are a few of those, or write a report, use the phone.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few of those around left that are still up. We still, you know, they're still there.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is the officers don't use them because they don't need to anymore. So I think when they were established, cell phones were not very prominent.
Mm-hmm.
We have pushed a ton of technology into the front seat of that police car, which is one of the challenges we have of getting people out of the car. Everything they need is sitting right around them in the front seat of that car. And so to need a desk to write a report or to go to a place to use the phone, they don't need to do that anymore. So, but we still have some of those available, and we have some that are supported by the communities, some that communities put coffee pots in there for them and all that. So, you know, where we have that, we use them, you know, not as frequently as we did, again, but most of that's driven by the technology and the things that are available to the officers in the car.
I'm not sure. I didn't get it. I wasn't trying to get it confusing, but I remember he just had those different substations. I call them stuff. I could probably be saying it wrong. And where when the crime happens, you know, in a certain area, they can leave from that station, that area that they are located.
Yes.
They can go immediately get to it quickly.
Yeah, that's a substation.
Okay.
So that's
okay.
So that's still in place. They report to work at that substation.
Okay.
They don't spend any time in the substation though.
Okay.
It's the typical day for a police officer is, come to work, you log on your computer in your car.
Okay.
You have a meeting with your supervisor in that substation, and then you go off to your area that you're assigned.
Okay.
And the dispatcher will send you calls based on, you know, the area you're assigned.
Okay.
And it starts from the moment you check on until you leave, you're constantly getting, here's your next call, here's your next call, here's your next call. And unfortunately, sometimes stacking of calls where you have 2 or 3 waiting on you, and you pass those off. When your shift is over, you may pass those off to the next guy coming on. So
gotcha.
That's a volume issue. But, yes, they are still kind of located all around the 6 zones in the city. And once you're assigned there, that's where you work every day. We don't move people around shift to shift, day to day. We leave them in the areas that they've been assigned to.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Are we going to go down the list?
Which report was that?
The
IACP report, correct, yeah. So they have a methodology that they use, and we have not yet officially, I know we've kicked that back and forth with them a little bit. I think I believe their plan is to introduce that officially to the city to give them that report. So what they did was come in, and we a deep dive analysis of the agency. we did this when I first came into office, except we did it with local business leaders, community leaders, activists. Tim Cost at JU chaired this commission for us, and so we broke the agency down in four areas and said, hey, dig into this for us and tell us what you think about staffing and zone boundary lines and all that. So we got some recommendations from the community back then that we answered all the recommendations. So we just felt like it was time to do that again. And so this time we used IACP. So we last time we used the community, this time we used a group of law enforcement professionals to do the same work. And so they have a methodology that I can't really explain to you other than they go unit to unit, and they look at crime numbers, and they look at different types of allocation that we have, and they say, hey, we think you should move this here, or you should do this way. And part of that is we believe you should have X number of officers additionally, and they should be in these places. So there's a lot of work being done yet, and I haven't dug into the line item yet of where those, you know, where they recommend those officers should be. Some of that we may not agree with. Some of that we may say we don't think that, you know, we need additional officers here. We think, you know, we might need additional ones over here, and they may not think we do. So there's some back and forth and some conversation to be had about that report. But I think it's always a good thing to have outside eyes come in and take a look at the organization and kind of give us some direction. Sometimes when you're too close to something every single day, you may miss something. So every 4 or 5 years to have that happen is not a bad thing. Years ago, John Payton and John Rutherford had a company called the Matrix Company come in and doing a similar type assessment, and they recommended back then 250 officers be hired. And I don't think we never hired those 250 officers. We were working on it. You can't hire them all at one time, obviously. We just never got to that 250. So you could have some residual of that. Not to mention that was over 10 years ago. So you've got population increases, those type of things. And they look at all that when they make a general recommendation for staffing.
Is there any way I can get some information about their methodology?
There may be some in the report. Again, I have not seen that part of it yet, but they will have some information in there. They used to have a formula they used. They don't use that formula anymore. So they may outline that in the final report that I haven't seen as of yet. So as soon as we have it, it's public record. It will make sure that I'll make sure that this commission gets everybody gets a copy of the report.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
This will just continue going around.
All right. I had a question regarding your thoughts on a community review board. I know there had been a bill put forth by Councilman Garrett. I think it's been referred several times.
Right.
And there was also a recommendation through the
Correct.
I'd like to know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so what they're talking about is a review board of officer conduct, I'm assuming. Again, it's not very clearly defined. And so one of the hurdles in that is, there's a couple of hurdles in it, but one of them is state law. So during state law for the state of Florida, an investigation on a police officer, so an internal investigation for misconduct, say, not for a violation of law, but for misconduct, that is confidential until it's over. Once it's over, it's all public record. So to have a civilian review board in the midst of that is a violation of state law. Now, after it's over, people looking at the outcomes, that can happen today. There's no need for anything additional for that to happen. Those reports are public record as I stand here before you today. I think when you talk about a citizen review board, the ability for people to look at those reports and weigh into the discipline on an officer, I'm not for that. There's a couple of reasons why. I think if we do our jobs, in particular I do my job as the elected sheriff, elected by the citizens in the community, to hold officers accountable and to be transparent, then that board's not necessary. And so if you look around the country, there are many, many citizen review boards in name that don't do anything, and they become really activist platforms. They become political tools. They, you know, a lot of times it's really emotions and politics instead of facts and evidence that drive some of those decisions. And so I think it's important for us as an agency to be transparent, and we are, and to hold officers accountable, which we have a great track record of. I think that's very important. So if you have that, you know, the best way to put it is, you know, you have citizen oversight of the sheriff's office comes in the form of the sheriff. So you know, I represent the community. I run the agency for the community. That's my perspective on it. If I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do as a sheriff, I get unelected, and they find someone else to come in and do that, you know, mandate that role. So I'm sure we'll have a lot of discussions about this at council when I was moving through, but I think there's better ways to address some of those concerns. One of the challenges I have with this particular board and the lack of a description of what this board will do is there's a big lack of understanding about what's already in place. And so I think before we talk about changing anything, we should have a big discussion about what is in place today. You know, how do we hold officers accountable today? How are we transparent today? Put those things on the table and examine those and then see if there needs to be a change. And I think most people, after looking at all of that, would say, you know what, I think what's in place is pretty effective. So, but again, I'm sure we'll have a lot of discussion about that in the next several months.
Sheriff, I'd like to follow up on the staffing level issue. I've been doing some outside research, and my number indicates there's a standard of 2.3 officers per 1,000. Census came in at 995, roughly.
Right.
We extract out the beaches, that puts us at about 935,000 in city of Jacksonville.
That's right.
Proper. Using your number earlier of, I think you said 1827.
That's correct.
On the staff. The standard would say we should be at about 2,150, which would imply we're short about 323. Is that an accurate estimate? Or
so that is, and that's one of the methodologies and formulas that's used around the country. IACP is not that simple with their calculations, but they all kind of end in the same way. So, you know, if you look at the state average, 2.3, national average sometimes can be a little higher. So, you know, that's a good benchmark, so to speak, and that's optimum. You know, not to say that the city's not safe if you don't have that many, but clearly there's more opportunities for community engagement. Clearly there's more opportunities for other work to occur when officers are not just focused on, well, you got just enough to do the core mission, you're only going to get the core mission done.
Right.
And so I think that's not a bad analogy. And that's really one that we look at as a base benchmark, same thing.
Okay, so that would tell us that if we could get up to that, let's say over a 3 or 4 year period, we made a commitment as a city to hire those extra officers, that would let them do more community engagement, do in-service training to elevate their skill level for areas that the community is demanding or requesting. So thank you
yeah,
very much
absolutely.
For that. I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sheriff. I had a couple questions, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to answer some of the questions that we had sent to you via letter. One program I was really excited about when you guys implemented it during COVID-19, obviously it kind of changed the way that you probably thought it was going to work, was the co-responder program that you got the federal grant from. Can you kind of talk about how that's been working? I think in a question period that one of your chiefs had at a Safer Together workshop, they had mentioned that there was only one or two that you were able to kind of start with. So
sure. And as we stand here now, there's three. And we just got a grant. I think the press release will go out end of this week or next week. We've got a grant through Mental Health Resource Center and LSF to add some of the clinicians. That's the challenge. So we're ready to commit the officers. The challenge is finding the people to work with them. And so this grant will help do that. And also this grant will provide some kind of back channel continuity of care from when that contact happens. So let me back up a minute and talk about, I'm a big fan of the co-responder program, by the way, but let me talk about what that program is versus what sometimes it's sold as. So, you know, the co-responder program is the idea where you have an officer who works in a neighborhood who knows the people in that neighborhood who have challenges, mental health challenges. And so prior to them being in crisis, we're able to interact with that individual or that individual's family, and we have a mental health professional with us to get them maybe back on track or make sure they stay on track with medications or treatment, that type of thing. The challenge comes when those individuals are in crisis mode. That's a challenge for anybody. It doesn't matter what the mental health person is that's there, the officer's training. I mean, we have the highest level of mental health training for law enforcement that you can have and do a lot of repetitive follow-on training to make sure that those levels are maintained. And really for law enforcement, it's really it's about de-escalation and recognition. You know, beyond that, we can't treat mental health issues. And so what has happened over the last, you know, 40 years in this country is that the mental health system has been defunded, it's been ripped apart, and a lot of that work has fallen to law enforcement. We're not mental health professionals. So while we can, you know, get training and recognize what we're dealing with, and we can do some basic, you know, de-escalation to help crisis situations in peacefully, which is what we want to do, that's not going to fix the issue, the system. And so, again, the co-responder program is really about intervening pre-crisis and using some of the tools that we've been able to put together in this community to help some of those families who don't have resources to be able to get the, you know, the health care they need when it comes to mental health. So we've opened two, we as a community, with Mental Health Resource Center and some federal funding, opening two comprehensive service centers in Jacksonville. And so those are great. I mean, you can, officers can take people there. They can walk up. So if you have mental health issues and challenges and you're dealing with, you know, all of that, you can go and they can help you and get you back on track, again, pre-crisis. So you're not having that interaction of, here's what we want to avoid. You want to avoid the interaction of a family having an individual where their only mental health plan is allow the person to go into full-blown meltdown mode and then call law enforcement. That's not a good plan. And unfortunately, that's a lot of people's plan to deal with their mental health challenges in their family. So, you know, it's puts us in a bad situation, clearly puts them in a bad situation. It's not good for anybody. The only tools that we have at that point or to physically compel that person to the back of that police car and get them to the Mental Health Resource Center. That's where the challenges come in. That's where we have problems. And so if we can intervene before that crisis happens, that's what we need to do, and that's what those co-responders will help us do. And so we are up to three, as I mentioned. We have still only one clinician. This grant will help us get the additional clinicians. And the idea is that we have, at the first phase anyway, one in every zone, one clinician and one officer dedicated full-time in every zone to be able to have those contacts and work with those families and make sure that he's kind of directing. And it's unique that law enforcement is involved in that way, but we have the first kind of the first visual into that. So,
yeah, your first point of contact.
Yeah, so we and we see the issues of what happens when it doesn't. So, you know, rather than refer it off, we have the mental health professional with us, and then there can be some kind of hand-holding instead of just, hey, here's a number to call, that type of thing, which has been happening for years around the country, but again, much more effective to have someone on site, you know, kind of doing some directing, again, some hand-holding when it comes to that.
Since you said you're a fan of the program, do you think, and I'm not going to say I know your budget more than you do,
sure.
But I'll ask you it this way. Do you think, since you support the program, that it could be something that is allocated for in the budget outside of trying to get a federal grant to pay for it? Getting a federal grant is always great because then it alleviates the stress of what you have to line up in your budget. But I almost think of this program as a potential for you to kind of deal with it almost in a SWAT type of way. And I only say that in the sense of having a dedicated team that has the resources to be able to deal with it across the county and kind of get it out of its infancy that it is now. So do you think that's something that you would like to see in the future? I'm trying to see where your vision is.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd like to see see it expand. And so when you say outside of the grant process, we're always going to leverage grant dollars where we can. And so, like, currently our investment is, you know, three full-time police officers working towards six full-time police officers. So you could see that expand. You know, we may have – I could see us in zones three and zone four potentially having more than one co-responder team just because of the volume and the populations being there. The model of having a like a SWAT team respond is a model that's been tried around the country. Some people still use it. The challenge with that is that's a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week staffing. And really those people are never working, and they're never where they're supposed to be or where you want them to be when you need them. And so what we took the step years ago, and I'll give Sheriff Rutherford credit for this, that training, that CIT training, which really does a lot to help us recognize what we're dealing – helps the officers recognize what they're dealing with. The idea is that you train a group of officers to be able to respond to do that. He made the commitment years ago, let's train everybody. So we add a full 40 hours to a full week to our police academy to make sure everybody gets that training. And then there's refresher and mental health first aid and all that through an officer's career, through the in-service training that we do every year. And so I think that having everybody trained in it, everybody having the recognition of it, and then having that the backup of the co-responders in the zones is a good model and a good plan. And so that's where I see it moving forward. The additional teams being where the population or where the need is, but certainly one in every zone and then going from there for sure.
Okay. You had mentioned earlier on that, and I apologize, this is the part when I was walking in, so I apologize for being late, that you said that you had a very young police force, and I've heard you said that many times as well. I'm sure when you're kind of thinking about budget season, you're trying to figure out what type of requests that you make to the mayor that ultimately gets in the final budget. Do you have an outlook within the 5-10 years as to how much your headcount type costs is going to increase? So I guess the city has a better idea as to where the costs may end up, because I think a lot of times when you're thinking about retention and the officers that the final ones that are in drop that are slowly sure. coming off, and then the new officers that you kind of have to bring up, how that will affect your budget overall. So I'm curious to see if that kind of goes into your thinking.
So budget projections based on staffing, those type of things, we do them every year. So there's a lot of that happens. I think a basic breakdown of our budget, remember, we're a little different than a lot of places because not only do we have, let's say, a law enforcement function to perform, we also have a correctional facility that we run in the county. We have three facilities. So we run the county's correctional operation, and we run court security as well. So in other places around the country, you may have a sheriff who does nothing but run the jail and court security, and then maybe you have a police department or multiple police departments that run the law enforcement operations. So we're unique in that you've got to find that right comparison when you're looking at budget numbers. For our budget, you're right, 85% of our budget is salaries and benefits. And then add the correctional facilities, then add court security, a lot of contractual obligations when it comes to corrections, obviously health care, food, all of those issues. It's a significant, you know, piece of the budget as well. So we've got some breakdowns that I can send you over. It's kind of a high-level breakdown, but kind of a pie chart, some percentages. But really the driver for our budget is always personnel. It's always people.
Okay. And then the last question I had, and I'd love to see that as
sure.
well. The last question I had, and it's kind of dovetailed to what Commissioner Roundsville was talking about. When you were talking about the Citizens Review Board, and I understood where state law is, I get that. Commissions like ours exist as a way for us to give public insider feedback to city council so they get a better idea as to certain issues that they don't really have the time to kind of look at.
Sure.
And then there's similar type boards or commissions for other constitutional officers. Do you think when the Safer Together workshops were going on, they were talking about maybe a policy board or citizens review board or where it kind of comes into the process? Do you think some kind of public type entity that looks at cases after internal reviews are over to kind of give some people better feelings about what happened would be useful? And I get what you're saying, where it's your job to do that. We get that. But sometimes giving people that feeling where they feel that true comfort kind of helps.
Sure, sure. So I think in talking about that conversation, the first thing, take a step back, what is that process today? So this conversation comes up a lot when it comes to officer-involved shootings. And so keep in mind that when an officer is involved in a shooting, that's a criminal investigation on that police officer, like a criminal investigation on anybody. And so if it gets to the point where the state says the officer violated the law, then it's going to be that process is exactly the same for any of us who violate the law, us being people in the community. And so there'll be a jury. So that process is the criminal justice process for that. If the state says, and we're asking three questions in officer-involved shooting, did they violate the law? Did they violate policy? Did they act in accordance with their training? So those are the only three questions that we're asking. So we look at the facts and evidence, and is that the case in these shootings? So the state is looking at, did they violate the law, the state attorney's office. If they didn't violate the law, then we get the case after that. It comes back to us, and it's an administrative review at that point. Are there policy violations related to the particular incident? Are there policy violations unrelated to the incident that we see because of body camera footage, maybe because of officer testimony, that type of thing? And then we take actions on that. So we review that through our response to resistance board. The best thing we did years ago was start that response to resistance board. So let people see that process. So it's not a rubber stamp. I've heard it described as, you know, one detective goes into a room, shuts the door, comes back out, you know, 2 weeks later and says the case is justified. That is the furthest thing from the truth. So back to, you know, understanding the current process is very important. So when we had the response to resistance boards, when we started it, they were open to the public. Because we were sued by the FOP, their position was it's part of an internal investigation on a police officer. It's protected by state law. You can't have people in there. We had family members. We had everybody in the board watching the board. Keep in mind, pretty high-level board. Officers come with attorneys. It's certainly not a rubber stamp board. I mean, they have to prepare when they come in there. You can lose your job in that board if you come in unprepared. And it's taken very seriously by everybody involved. So we had an opportunity. We had citizens in there actually watching and viewing that. Rutherford lost that case in court. We took it back again for review when I was elected to try to open the boards back up again because it does exactly what you're talking about. We lost again. It's a direct violation, they say, of state law. So what we did in response to that was record those boards and post them online. So while you can't be there, state law says you can't be there during the investigation, which is what that board is deemed during the investigation. My thought was you can certainly see it after. It's public record. And so we have a transparency website that really is one of probably five or six in the country. We got it from Philadelphia. And when we have an officer-involved shooting, we track from the day it occurred, the officers involved, the suspects, the location, all the way through the state attorney's office investigation, that document posted online, that report, usually a big report posted online. Our process, you follow along the entire process where there's a board, you get to see the board where there's body camera footage is posted online for everybody to see. So, again, it's about, you know, being transparent in the process. And so in terms of the officer-involved shootings, there's nothing out there that you could convene a group to look at all that if you want to. The entire community can look at it today. There doesn't have to be a gatekeeper group to watch that through the community. Anybody in the community can look at that and make their judgment about what they think about that. And again, I think that's what is you know necessary in terms of being able to be transparent with the community. So we have a lot that we do, and again, I think you've got to consider that in the process when you talk about what's the need for the board. If it's transparency, I would say tell me another agency that is as transparent as we are, and then tell me how this board improves that. And I'm not sure you have a direct answer about how that will occur.
One of the things we were talking about with in the city, there's a lot of gang violence, or it appears to be through what we hear over the news and all that there's a lot of gang violence. And I understand that just kind of what's going on, how successful are any programs be to fight that, to get to the root of it?
So we first kind of a description of the problem. So it's, you know, the gang violence gets all the attention, obviously, but it's a bigger combination of issues. So gang violence is certainly part of it. We focus on what we call group or gang. Doesn't have to be a gang. Gangs are defined by statute in Florida. So you have to meet certain criteria to be called a gang or a gang member or a gang associate. That's not the case around the country. It's different in different states, obviously. We also have organizations that are clearly criminal enterprises that don't meet that statutory definition of gang. And so, you know, it's group-involved violence is where the focus is, and where a lot of the research is now around the country as well. So we have a lot of programs in place that work on that. We've had pockets of success. We're having a good run of success this year. We're down about 40 homicides year to date. That is completely opposite of the national trend. It's got a lot to do with the work that we've done in the last 5 years. And granted, you know, you've got to – you certainly can't rest on your laurels And you haven't heard me out there talking about it a lot simply because we count numbers at mid-year and end of the year. And so when the end of the year comes, we'll talk about how this year looked. But the trend is you know, certainly one we like, obviously. So, but we have a couple programs that really focus on that. The technology I mentioned that, you know, ShotSpotter is part of it. We have something called the Gun Crime Intelligence Center, where we not only have ShotSpotter in play, but we have NIBIN, the gun DNA that really helps in investigations. We have our real-time crime center cameras that are tied into that. We're able to get some great video footage of crime scenes and crimes, sometimes as they occur, which is incredible. So we were able to build a lot of that out and are continuing to build pieces of that. Investigatively, that's helped quite a bit. We've also, from a prevention standpoint, been working with a group called the National Network for Safe Communities since about 2016 is when we first engaged them. And so there's a lot of work that we do on the preventative end of people that we know are going to be involved in group or gang violence. And so it is a community-wide effort. We have a lot of community sponsors and that help us with this, pastors and nonprofits and all. And it's about reaching the families of those young men typically, or those young men themselves, to be able to say, look, here's where you're headed. Here's where your path is headed. It's jail or prison or death, really, are the only two options here. And so, but we have an opportunity for you to change that. And it's not the sheriff's office or the sheriff necessarily, but it's, again, a lot of faith-based partners, a lot of community nonprofits, you know, offering education to move people out of the city, job opportunities, all kind of different things. And we've had a lot of people take us up on that. We do that through a couple of ways. We have a call-in where we bring people into one room. We deliver that message to them. There's a lot of state and federal partners in the meeting. We talk about the law enforcement consequences, and then we have a mother who lost her son to gun violence speak to them. Then we have some of the nonprofits saying, here are the things that we can do for you to help you. And then, you know, a lot of, again, it's a very faith-based driven operation here for us. When we can't get them into one room, we do something called a custom notification. We go out and look for the individual, look for the family. And it's to deliver them a message. Look, we need to, if it's the individual, here's some things you need. Here's what's going to happen to you. Here's your social circle. Here's your, you know, friend, five friends, and three are dead and two are in prison. This is where you're going to be. So, you know, but here's opportunities. Let's change it. Let's change the path. And so, again, it's been very effective. So that in combination with, you know, the Cure Violence program, I know that was part of the questions. I'm a fan of that work. I think that there's value in that. Those violence interrupters. You see it being successful in cities all around the country. And I haven't seen, again, it's not a JSO program, it's a city program. And I haven't seen recent data. First quarter data this year is, I think, all I've seen. But you'd have to think that they're having an impact with the reduction in murders and homicides that we've seen this year. So and all these things, by the way, take time to work. So you look at a city like Oakland, who's really already on the climb again. Oakland was the poster child for the last few years of here's how you reduce violence in a community. They reduced their homicides by half, by 50%. But it took 8 years to do that. It's not easy work to do. It's not that someone's making a mistake and you make a quick correction and now you're going to reduce your homicides. It's a community-based effort. Law enforcement has to partner. Faith-based people have to partner. Nonprofits have to be in. So it's organizing that big machine and getting it running. And they did it. They did it in Oakland successfully. The challenge with cities around the country where you see they backslide away from it is you get a new mayor or a new chief. I want a new program. I want my stamp on something. And they back away from that type of work. And you see the numbers climb. So this is one of only a few evidence-based violence reduction strategies that you'll find. And so, we've been kind of boots on the ground. Early conversations 2016, boots on the ground 2018. Working in the city, so I believe that we're having some impact there. So again, a combination of all that together is helping us be successful.
Thank you.
I had one last question for you, and then yes, we can close you out because I know we took. Oh, I'm sorry.
Quick one.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
I just have a quick kind of a comment. Your Sheriff's Watch program.
Yes, ma'am.
It's a very good program. I'm a member, so I know it's very good. I wish there was a way to get more people involved.
I agree.
I think if the communities knew more about the program,
right,
and what it does, it would be very beneficial in the community. Is there any kind of thoughts or ideas on how it could get more community people involved, or at least know about the program?
Right, right.
And then they would, you know, maybe...
Yeah, we do a lot of you know, word of mouth advertising. Obviously, we ask the members, as you know, you've probably heard us ask, bring a neighbor, bring a friend, that type of thing. Something we did when I first came into office is the reason it went from Shadco to Sheriff's Watch is that the big push was let's pull the neighborhood watch groups in. There's really not a national neighborhood watch organization, so it's a great idea. It's really a grassroots kind of thing. You've got some framework there, but there's nobody leading that group of people or here's the direction for you know, Neighborhood Watch. So we said, let's just take it over. Let's bring it and make it part of Sheriff's Watch. So we had some growth when we did that. But as you know, it's up and down. And so we've lost a lot of interaction during COVID. And so I think you'll see the numbers come back up as we, you know, hopefully pull away from, you know, the more serious parts of the pandemic. We're able to get people back together and draw people in. But we're going to advertise and put information out. We have safety fairs and, you know, we're at JAG games and we're at baseball games and just encouraging people to passing out those pamphlets and trying to get people to get engaged and get involved. But I appreciate you being involved in the program. And it is our flagship program. I mean, it is the way people talk about community policing. That's it. That's a great example of it. An officer meeting with the community that he works with once a month, talking about challenges in that neighborhood and then responding back. Hey, I got this complaint. Here's what we did. Or this individual, we've got this person help, or this individual's gone to jail, or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, there's a wide, or hey, we've directed them to this city service. You know, as you hear, there's a lot of things that come up in Sheriff's Watch that are not law enforcement related. But we take ownership of it and make sure it gets to the right place and that work gets done. So it is one of our flagship programs. So, but thank you for being involved in it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So those do not work for me. So the Duval County School Board has its own police department. So now we have been helping them in the last couple of years. State law changed about 3 or 4 years ago, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Act, where you had to have an armed individual on campus to protect the school from outside threats. And so we partnered with the school board as they were building their force to be able to do that. And so we are still working in elementary schools and charter schools. And so we're in the process of pulling back from that as they continue to hire more people to fill that role. But, yeah, it's not our – those are not our police. But they can do the same work. They can do the same work. So they have the challenge of staffing and, you know, in the school environment, they have the challenge of staffing and workload as well. But there's opportunities for them to do some community engagement type work in the school. Absolutely, yeah. We had that years ago, and it was a good program. It really was. I think it does allow an opportunity to be able to build relationships at that level, which is what we're doing at Ed White with Bridging the Gap. And so, you know, we go. It's a 6-Saturday program. We stipend the young men to come. So, you know, if they say I don't want to come because I was getting a job, we'll pay you to be here, but you come and sit and listen and interact with us and talk to us, and you've seen relationships build outside of that. It's good work, and so you know, we'll continue to focus on things like that. But building a relationship at that level is incredibly important. It's one thing to build them in the neighborhood; you have to do that. But you've got to work at every level. You know, building relationships and having those conversations about, you know, interacting and being comfortable interacting with law enforcement. I agree.
Along with the talking about the Sheriff's Watch. And I'm with the CPAC as well. Sure. And it seems one of our biggest problems, and I've heard it from the people that come to the CPAC from Sheriff's Watch, how do we get the younger generations involved?
Yeah, that's a challenge.
Our CPAC probably, and I'm CPAC 4, probably 90% or 60 or older.
Right.
And maybe even 95%. So do you have any ideas about how to get those younger generations involved, the millennials or whatever?
I tell you, we've talked a lot about it.
Take an interest in their community?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about it. You know, we went through a period of time where we were trying to do the meetings online. We thought maybe that would help engage a little bit more, and we got no more engagement than we typically do. I think you to the long haul, is building those relationships at the teenage level, getting them engaged in that. I think civics conversations in high school, not just about law enforcement, but about, hey, get engaged in your community. It's a partnership from just speaking of law enforcement. What makes law enforcement successful is a partnership with the community. If the community won't partner, it's tough. It really is. And so you've got to continue to work to, you know, obviously make yourself an attractive partner, right? You want to be doing the right things and doing all the good stuff in the community and doing a good job. And then hopefully you'll get people engaged in those conversations. But it is a challenge. The neighborhoods in our city where we are most successful, they are the neighborhoods where we have the most interaction with the community. I mean, it's not even close. I mean, so, we'll continue to work on that and focus on it. But you're right. I think the challenge is, how do you engage a new generation of youth in good conversations and daily partnership, though? We have a lot of really engaged young people in the community, which is a good thing. But we've got to get questions answered, and they've got to be comfortable in the conversation. All that has to happen. But then we've got to get to an active partnership, you know. So just that's the goal. But you're exactly right to identify that as a challenge, no doubt.
I want to sneak in one last question.
Yes, sir.
It was from the letter. Can you kind of talk about the gun buyback programs? Because I know we haven't seen one of those in the past. We've seen those in the past, but I haven't seen them lately. So I was curious to see if it was because of a cost issue, or it was just you didn't think there
so
was...
we've never spent taxpayer money on a gun buyback. I'll tell you an interesting story. So years ago, Sheriff Rutherford was sheriff, and he was approached by Ms. Weaver, Dolores Weaver, about doing a gun buyback program. And so I went with him, and we were talking about it. I was the chief in investigations at the time, so we're discussing the gun buyback. And we had looked at those around the country. They're typically not effective. They don't reduce crime in the neighborhood. They don't reduce crime in the city. It gets people engaged. Makes people feel good about being involved in the community. So we have the conversation with Ms. Weaver, and she actually said, "Hey, I'll buy the guns, and I'll give you $50 to Powell for every gun that I buy." So we leave, and he goes, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, Sheriff, typically, there's no evidence that says buybacks are effective, and I don't know that we should do it." He goes, "Good, you're in charge of it. You need to make it work." I said, "I'll do it." So we came up with two things. We said, "Look, what will it do? It'll get the community engaged about the conversation about gun violence. That's positive, and that's true. And it'll give people who have a gun in their home who want to get rid of it the opportunity to safely do that without selling it online or doing it, you know." So there were some positives that came out of it. And again, all privately funded. But typically they don't have any impact on crime or that issue at all. But there's value in, again, those two things. It was interesting to see the number of people. You get a lot of junk, people cleaning out their gun cabinets or whatever and pieces and parts and old rusty guns. But you would see a lot of maybe widows or people in a family that someone died and left guns, and they don't want them. And they don't want to sell them. They just want to get rid of them. And they bring them up, and for $50, we take them, and then they're all destroyed, they're all melted down. So, if you had a private funder, is there any value in creating the conversation and giving people can always bring us a gun, and if they don't want it, any officer will take it, and we'll take it to the property room, and it'll eventually be destroyed. But the buybacks are kind of an event to get that to happen, but to have people have the conversation about, you know, gun violence and why are you doing this? And, you know, even though, you know, statistically we know and there's no evidence to support that it has any really effect at all, it may have a positive effect on engaging the community. But short, long answer to your question, but we don't have any of those scheduled up to this point. I haven't done any in probably, it's been a while. It's been probably 10 years, I bet, since we did the last one.
Thank you so much for staying longer than
I know. No problem. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity. Yeah.
But I know a lot of us were really excited when you said yes to the invitation, so we really appreciate the time.
Well, look, those are great questions. You guys are right on point with all the things that we think are important in the city, and there's a great team over there working day in and day out. I would say this. I think that, you know, as we have conversations moving forward about Civilian Review Board and legalization of marijuana at the local level, those type of things, and I want to comment on that too, if I can, just a second.
Sure.
I think that we've got to continue to have the conversations, but from a standpoint of what is it, what's in place today, what are we doing today, and how does this conversation make what we're doing today better? And if there's a win there, there's a win. I'm all for a win. But if it's just about some other agenda, then I don't think it's worth upsetting the entire apple cart and turning something over that is effective to something that we know historically around the country has not been effective. So I want to mention the marijuana thing because I'm hearing it come up over and over again. The local decriminalization of marijuana. So first issue, the jail is not full of people arrested for marijuana. We make about 30 or 40,000 arrests a year. Last year, we arrested 100 people for possession of marijuana. That was the only charge. And so since then, really based because of COVID, we have taken the posture of any nonviolent misdemeanor offense, we are issuing a misdemeanor citation. If that individual qualifies for that and the officer wants to make a physical arrest, he has to ask for approval from his supervisor to be able to do that. So that's because of jail population, COVID issues. We don't need anybody in jail that doesn't need to be there. Jail's for people who the community's afraid of, not to punish people. So, you know, we're trying to make that adjustment. So there's things in place already that do that. The challenge with the local legalization of marijuana, I don't think if you looked at a state recreational marijuana law that you would get a lot of pushback. I don't think you would. Because when you do it at the state level, you have an industry come in and provide a regulated product to people who wanted to use it. And you would know what THC level is. You'd know that there's nothing else in that product. And it, again, it would be a regulated product, much like alcohol. Now, there's a lot of arguments to have. Is that good for the community? Is it good for young people? Again, those are all discussions that need to be had. But the state level is where those need to happen. The challenge with local level is this. To decriminalize it or not enforce it, if the state attorney and the sheriff and the mayor and I stood up and said, we'd like to say that we're not going to enforce marijuana, the state's not going to prosecute it, and, you know, go forth and do what you will. A lot of people are going to go try to find some marijuana. I think a lot of people will say, hey, maybe I will. If I'm not going to jail, maybe I won't try it. The challenge to me is, where are they going to get that marijuana from? They're going to be driven to an open-air drug market that are typically fraught with violence. They always are. That's one of the drivers of violent crime in the community is the drug trade. So you're sending people to go get something that you can't buy anywhere else but on the street, typically. And then what are they buying? I mean, they're going to buy marijuana with who knows what laced in it. We routinely find marijuana laced with fentanyl, which is a huge issue in our community and every community around the country. And so it's not a safe product. It's not safe to buy, and it's not a safe product. So I think you'd have a different conversation and a different position from a lot of people, again, if it was at the state level and it was regulated and people knew what they were buying. Again, it's up to them whether or not they want to partake in it or not. But if they do, you know it's safe. You know exactly what it is you're buying. And so that's the challenge I have. I have not heard an argument that moves me off of that yet, honestly. So I know, there's conversation about that, but that'll be my position when that comes up. So go ahead.
No, go ahead. What
were you saying? I was just going to thank you for having me. So if you have something good, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Thank you, guys. Take care.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, sir. You guys had a lot of good questions, but I appreciate all of you sneaking in as many as you could because you know me, I will. If I could sit here and ask 1,000 different questions, I probably would, to my own chagrin. But to move it right along, public comment, we have Stanley Scott. So, Mr. Scott, you're recognized for your time to speak.
Scott with the African American Economic Recovery Think Tank. I come here to talk about another subject here, but I will get back to concerning JSO, because there was a few things that I totally disagree, and we have empirical evidence to show that they're on the wrong track. But I also want to say I'm advocating for the fact that we have a city police in Jacksonville. And let the sheriff go back to doing their duty, what they used to do before consolidation. Okay, moving on. My main concern when I came back here is concerning ethics in this city. We just had four city councilmen get $800,000 for a nonprofit that they participate in employment, in leadership, as far as CEO. And nobody don't see anything wrong with that? Now, we know we have empirical evidence to show that Lala is politically motivated. And you continue to see the same thing. You had the same issue when you come to social justice. Same exact issue. City council members took the money in social justice and passed it out to who they wanted to pay, pass it out to. Brenda Priestley Jackson, who was the author, the chairperson of the social justice, along with some another city council member. But in y'all position, unless I'm reading the information wrong, and I'm known to be wrong, and I will read it again and come back again, and so y'all can correct me. But I understood the city council to work for the people, not for themselves. And I'm getting to see it often in this city here. City council members start their own program or get a friend or one of their crony friends to run a program. And they're not talking about a little bit of money. They're talking about hundreds of thousands. And y'all don't see nothing wrong with that? Do you understand why Jacksonville is a second-tier city? It's not my information. It's information I read. I read through the Time Union and other news media. Then I come in front of organization of your level, and I heard you ask some question with the sheriff. It blew my mind. The sheriff worked for the governor. Now, I have no personal issue with JSO, but I have been around JSO many times. And when you meet with some of them young folks, that I'm a little older now, young folks, they got a mentality when they come to African-American, that we are criminals. They have the same issue, and I'm putting all this together here because it shows a leadership problem in Jacksonville. Where y'all supposed to be advocating for doing the right thing, controlling and helping and maintaining the people's trust. So the reason why I'm sitting here, standing here today, is because I see so much ignorance in this leadership. And then I come to a meeting of this nature here, and all y'all are good folks. But I'm complex that y'all are not knowledgeable about what's going on in this city unless y'all are part of the problem. But when you look at Jacksonville, it's in bad shape. Thank you.
Sir? Like we have any other public comments, so we can go right into the auditor's report. So, Tommy, you're up.
Yes, sir. Through the chair to the commission, the council auditor's office has released two reports since the last true commission meeting. As mentioned in the September 9th True Commission meeting, report number 850, the debt management fund audit was released on September 9th, which was the day of our meeting, and I was not able to review the audit with the True Commission has been released. So I'm going to start with, we'll review three, but we've only released two since the last meeting, I guess. So the report number 850, which was the debt management fund audit, was released on September 9th, 2021. What we found overall, the debt management fund collected and was scheduled to collect more funds through through billings to the departments that weren't then were needed to meet the debt management fund's portion of the city's external debt service. This has resulted in the debt management fund accumulating a $19.5 million fund balance. The $19.5 million fund balance would have been $28.5 million if not for the $9 million that the debt management fund has contributed to other subfunds over the years, which is as approved by various legislation, mainly from the general fund, the general services district. Additionally, the debt management fund was slated to accumulate an additional $43 million more in available fund balance by October 1, 2047, assuming no changes were made to the planned collections. And the main cause of this is the planning and structuring of the internal collections, which includes not taking into account reserves, issues with internal loans, and also external loans and interest earnings. So we also noted specific issues that there were a lack of documented procedures related to the loan management system. There were issues with the initial setup of internal loans resulting in over collections. There were various issues with the actual collection of internal loans, and we found issues with duplicate internal loans created in the loan management system, resulting in some double billing. We also found issues with restructuring of internal loans after the refunding of external bonds or when funds were transferred to other projects. We recommended that the Treasury Division establish procedures related to the loan management system, that they implement a method to structure internal collections that does not result in significant excess funding accumulated in the debt management fund, which by doing that, that takes away funding from other initiatives. Then we, that Treasury Division perform reconciliations between the loan management and financial systems to ensure the accuracy of various activities. That's kind of an overview of that audit, if anybody has any questions on that one.
Any questions on that audit?
All right. And on report number 813A was released, which is the follow-up on the tourist development and convention development taxes audit, was released on September 23rd, 2021. The original report, number 813, which was the audit of the tourist development and convention development taxes, was released on July 26, 2018. What we found in this follow-up, this is the first follow-up, the original audit, we had five issues, had two internal control weaknesses, one finding, and two opportunities for improvement. There were issues that were cleared was one internal control weakness and one opportunity for improvement. So there are three remaining issues. What we found, there was a systems calculation issue. The issue in the original audit was a calculation error by the computer program used by the tax collector to track tourist development and convention development taxes, resulting in the understatement of a dealer's tax due. The error occurred when a payment sent to the tax collector was both short of the amount due and submitted late. And we recommended that the tax collector review the correct system setup so the outstanding amount would be calculated accurately in all instances. In their updated response, the tax collector stated that a new tax system was on schedule to be fully operational by August 2021, and they would require the contracted vendor to provide an accurate system calculator. Their response to our finding was their office remains on schedule with the implementation of the new tax system, and they feel certain the new system will resolve calculation inconsistencies. Another internal control weakness that we found was the access rights issue. We found the issue in the original audit was that 8 out of 86 users with access to the tourist development convention development taxes module of the tax collector system had excessive access rights. We recommended that in that audit the tax collector review and modify the access rights. In their updated response, the tax collector said they would address any issues with user access rights during the conversion to the new system. So they're still getting that system implemented, and they also stated, in addition, they have a policy in place that annually ensures review of access rights. And then we had an opportunity for improvement of not collecting taxes from peer-to-peer property rental, which is like the Airbnb companies. They did not submit. The issue in the original audit was that the peer-to-peer property rental companies did not submit tourist development and convention taxes to the city. We recommended the administration work with the applicable parties to decide how to proceed with these issues. In their updated response, the Finance Administration Department stated that due to zoning issues, the proposed ordinance that sought to resolve this matter failed to pass, and there is still no agreement in place with the peer-to-peer property rental companies to collect and remit the taxes on behalf of the hosts. So there's really, until there's legislation that is passed, they're estimated that the Finance Administration Department estimates that approximately $500,000 is under collected annually from these.
Probably more.
That was an estimate. So the Finance and Administration Department response said they're working on this. They plan to sit down with the incoming leadership of City Council, but in the meantime, they've hired a firm to audit accounts which do exist, albeit that we are likely only seeing a fraction of the total short-term rentals due to the current manual collection, payment, and reporting method that is required of landlords. That now.
Is the last legislation that they're referring to, because the only one I remember the last one we did was in 2018 or 19 from Councilmember Love, if I remember correctly, because I think he's the last time I've seen that kind of legislation before.
You're correct. They had a special committee, and it was about 2018 or so, that looked into the problem, and they could never come to any kind of conclusion as to which way. The committee was kind of split. There were some people who said, just leave them alone, let them do what they want to do. They're not bothering anybody. The other side said, they're ruining neighborhoods. We don't know who these people are. We're not collecting the tax. We got to do something. And they could never agree on anything, and so they just kind of gave up and disbanded.
I think it's the same thing that happened with Uber and Lyft, too. All right, any questions on that one? Thank you, Tommy.
Moving on. The final report, number 851, which was the David compliance attestation for the clerk of courts. This was released on September 24th of 2021. Excuse me. David stands for Driver and Vehicle Information Database System. And this attestation was to ensure that internal controls are in place to protect personal data in the system from authorized, unauthorized access, distribution, use, modification, or disclosure pursuant to the memo of understanding between the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles and the Duval County Clerk of Courts between October 1, 2018 and July 31, 2021. As part of that memorandum of understanding, they have to have an internal either a licensed CPA, its internal auditor, or inspector general, the clerk of court, is to provide an attestation from one of those items. The council auditor's office acts as the internal auditor for the city, so this is why we did this attestation. We issued our opinion. In our opinion, there are adequate controls in place to protect personal data in the David system from unauthorized access, distribution, use, modification, or disclosure pursuant to the memorandum of understanding. All deficiencies and issues found during the review have been corrected and measures enacted to prevent reoccurrence. We found a few instances. The quarterly quality control reviews were not always completed timely. We found that 8 out of 12 quarterly were not completed within the required 10 days. and except for two, all were completed within 10 days after the due date. And the two that took longer were during the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. So that's why those were within 10 days. We also found that the contact information of the new clerk of courts who took office on January 5th, 2021 was not updated timely in the David system. The contact information was updated in the David system on September 10, 2021, after we asked about the changeover. It should have been done within 10 calendar days, but...
It took them 9 months.
So they have put procedures in place to stop that from happening. And then there was opportunity for improvement, basically, that we said the quarterly quality control review of training and access rights. Basically, two opportunities in this one that related to the first related to adding a step to look at the length of time has passed since each user has accessed the system. If they haven't accessed within a certain time, then is there need to review to see if there's a need for them to have that access rights. And the other one, we recommended added a step to the quarterly quality control review that would verify each employee has completed the required training within the year. We found 4 out of 9 users who had access to the David system that had not completed their annual required instructional training within the last year. So we recommended that they not have access until they complete the training. That concludes my report, if there are no questions.
Any questions on this report? You got off scot-free there.
That system's a pain. I used to have to work with it when I was in risk management.
Is it just like hard to manage, or is it just not very user friendly?
There's a lot of steps you have to take to make sure that people don't get to maintain access or keep access, and you have to track how many times they access and how many times they, and you got to make sure that they don't access what area they're not supposed to access. So the there's a whole lot of different codes and stuff you got to put in to make sure that, because as a city safety officer, we had to check everybody that was had a city driver's license, city certification. So that's why our main use was to do that. And we had those same statements of attestation we had to get done every year and every quarter. My responsibility of doing that was to get those done and turned in and all that stuff. So, and they don't like it if you don't do it. You get letters until you do get it.
All right. I know there was an audit committee report. Commissioner Roberts, was there anything that sparked your interest on bills that were introduced for legislative tracking?
What?
On bills that were introduced, the...
Well, there is a few that are of interest, and I think the big one is the one that's involved in the shipyard. Kids, I guess it's called now. And that one, I found two problems that, as far as they're concerned with myself, is that number one, there is a provision for $36,000 a year is a lease, and there's no escalator provided. That means inflation will eat it up in no time. Second one is that the same thing is true on the $200,000 per year provided for maintenance.
Yeah.
I did an overall analysis with a dynamic model where I assumed 2.1% inflation, $225 a night for a hotel, 176 rooms, tax rate of 2%, and an occupancy rate of 66.2, which is the 2019 U.S. average. And I found that over the entire period of 40 years after you've deflated everything or handled it for inflation, that we have gotten in about $12 million We've put out about $118 million. I don't know if you can call that a good deal or not. The second thing.
It's a sweetheart deal.
It's a sweetheart contract. Second thing has to do with the collective bargaining agreements that were made. I did some analysis on that. I found that if you go back to 2007, as far as Jeff could get me, our employees have not kept up with inflation. Right now, the Fraternal Orders of Police are perhaps best off with only 0.9% slack. The IAFF, they're 2.1% off of inflation. And the AFSCME is 0.9% behind inflation. All these people, to varying degrees, don't have the purchasing power that they had back in 2007. The second thing that hit me was that there are substantially different pay increases negotiated. I've had a lot of experience in labor relations, and the very worst thing you can do is make a different deal between unions. And I would predict that we're going to have a lot of trouble with that.
Are you talking about the difference between the law enforcement increases and the general employee?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. Even the generals. There's differences between the LIUNA, ASME, all of those. There's differences in all of those, not just
there's
police
difference in
and
them
fire.
All, there
all
is
of them
no,
are different.
No uniformity shown. And I'd like to suggest that we have someone Sorry come in here and explain what the collective bargaining procedures are. Well, that really kind of covers the things I wanted to cover. Any questions?
Do you think because they used a lot of the Recovery Act funding in order for them to do the increases that affected the way that they negotiated, or do you see a pattern in which the increases that they negotiate when the contracts end are not uniform?
I have no idea what criteria they used. As I said, this is a situation that anyone, I think, in their right mind who's a negotiator would have avoided.
Anyone else have any thoughts?
That concludes my presentation.
Jeff, council is gonna. When I know they submitted the union contracts. When's that up for review?
Tuesday night.
Oh, for final approval?
Okay. They were in the committees this past week.
Since you. Is there a particular person that you're interested in having come speak to how negotiations are usually done or to get more context? Or I don't want to leave you hanging on that on
you
that thought.
I have a chief negotiator, and I'd like to hear from him.
Jeff, do you have any context as to how that?
There is an employee in the Employee Services Department who is our chief negotiator. And he was the one who made the presentations in finance this week. I can get in touch with him and see if he would be willing to come.
Mr. Roberts, is that something you'd be interested in?
Very much so.
I think you got your request there. And that's your world, too, because you did labor relations before. So.
Yeah,
it's your bailiwick.
I did stuff for the whole rail industry.
All right. Any other pieces of legislation that you want to speak to?
Well, there are. Run through a few. I have notes. I see that we've entered into an agreement with other counties in Florida on how to divvy up any money that comes out of opioid lawsuits. There's a proposal to eliminate all the at-large seats in the city council. And a further proposal to align the election dates, local elections, same as those for governor. I think those are perhaps the most significant ones.
Save $4 million. All right. Anyone have any questions for Commissioner Roberts or bills that they thought that they were interested in that they wanted to speak to? I don't have any chair's comments. I think a lot of the questions that we had in our letter, we got addressed. So I was just curious just to have as an open dialogue. Do you think you're able to get all your questions answered? Got it. How does everyone? Okay. So I guess that's we're at that phase now that we've kind of gotten his comments. And we spent a lot of the beginning of the year looking at data in the comparable cities across the country. Do you think we're at that step where we start to kind of compile his comments, compile the data, look at his comments and kind of put that together in a report, or is there still other areas that you would like to look at before we get to that stage?
I'm sorry, I was making notes. I didn't quite get your comment.
No, you're okay. I use these as QA situations. Okay, I said in the beginning of the year, we spent a lot of our time looking at the comparable city data. And one of the things a lot of the commissioners wanted to do is also hear directly from the sheriff to give his viewpoints as to how they're dealing with crime, how they spend their dollars, what are some of the ways that they're trying to deal with this moving forward. Now that we've gotten those two things done, do you think we're at a point where you want to start drafting a report based on our findings? Are there any other entities or individuals that you would like to get invited to speak to give you a better picture?
I know, I think that we've really covered the with it.
I'm good.
I will say there's one piece that we haven't talked about, and I think that's and he kind of mentioned it in passing when he was talking about the prevention type programs and how the city administers those with Kids Hope Alliance. I think that would probably give us insight on that final piece, because one of the things I think we discussed is how much the city spends in terms of intervention type dollars, and that's not purely housed in JSL. So I think that would be helpful to kind of give us the holistic viewpoint to give a intelligible report. But that's just me. I'm just curious. I'll just put that out there. Jeff, is there anyone that we could invite at Kids Hope Alliance to kind of talk about the programs that they have and how they kind of spend the dollars that they do each year?
I can talk to Mike Weinstein, who's the CEO, and ask him if either he or somebody on his staff that he thinks would be knowledgeable and could come talk about things.
Okay. And then do you guys want to do the same process about thinking about some questions ahead of time that we can submit so that way they're prepared for us, or do you just want to invite them over and then we kind of springboard on questions that may come to us? Okay. So if you have any questions that you would have for whoever Jeff ends up getting to commit to come, if you could submit them to Jeff, and then he can compile that in a letter, and we can submit it the same way that we did with the sheriff, so that way we have a baseline to kind of start from for when we actually receive an invitation to for them to come and speak. Other than that, it looks like we're in the Sheriff's Office Comparable City Research. I'm not sure whether or not this JSO accent data was related to that or
no, no it's not. Something. It's okay. Not.
Okay. Any updates on that particular line item? Because I know the last time we kind of talked about it was in the the summer? No? Okay. And I know Pierce City's comparison research was kind of talked about from Commissioner Roberts' last meeting. Are there any other additional points that you wanted to make on that line item?
I started writing, and I've gotten as far as giving a pretty good description economically, demographically, and found that I need to add some things and make changes in the database. For example, I need to isolate what's called component units from other expenses. And I also found it would be helpful to say something about climates. Well, we compare good and bad with the other cities, the other peer cities. And I'm ready right now to start writing the part that deals with how much each of us spends on what. And I hope at the end to come up with some conclusion.
Okay. Any questions for Commissioner Roberts? All right. Any new business items? I'm assuming this is when we can kind of talk about the your data.
Well, either there are commissioners' comments, which is either one.
Oh, okay. Any new business items? All right. Commissioner comments.
Just an update. I know earlier we first started, I kind of had an interest in figuring out information on the accidents, vehicle accidents from the Sheriff's Department, JSO, and I was able to get some information. I did not get as deep a dive as I had hoped for when I got the information from both risk management and from fleet. I'm not sure I really wanted as deep a dive as I got thinking about it. I probably would have had boxes full of information when you talk about accidents. Well, let's look at the number we have. But this is just a breakdown of what I found. Auto liability, medical, incurred, and what's paid. Those that have asterisks means that they haven't, the final information hasn't been closed out yet on some of the, that's why you see a disparity in the incurred and the paid. One of the reasons, it just kind of a breakdown of how much has been spent. Also, it shows the subrogation of a workers' comp. And when you look at the records comp, in particular, from 2016 to 2016, I'm not really confident in those figures because of the difference. As you see, it jump up to 2017. You know, you're talking about almost seven times more than what it was in 16. And I don't really believe that that's an accurate number. But even if you start at 2017 to 2019, we're almost double the amount of money spent on workers' comp expenses. And there you go, look at in 2019, for instance, it's incurred $1.367 million and we're only paid out $931. So there's a lot of cases that haven't been closed. Also, if you look at the next line of subrogation, that this is money that has been recovered from accidents that were caused by other third-party individuals. And I do know for a fact, because I was with risk management, a lot of this and stuff, that in 2017, they did make increase the system of getting back the monies back from accidents that we were involved in that somebody else has caused. And that's why there was a significant increase from 2017 to 18. There's, you know, $300,000 difference. And I haven't put it all together yet because I just got the last of it figured out. I've had some issues with health and all that. But the fleet repair, damage and repair, you see the figures down there. And while it looks, if you look at the whole budget for JSO, this may seem like a small percentage. But it's not only the percentage of how much physical cost it is dollar-wise, it's the amount of cost to the individuals that are involved in these accidents that I think we need to worry about. The final thing that I'm going to try to do is find out what they do after a police officer is involved in an accident. What do they have going on to, especially if it's employee at fault, and you can see there's each of those years there's 300 to 400 employee at fault. What are they doing to make a change in that? I know that when one of the systems or one of the programs that the city has through risk management is what we call our vehicle safety board, and it doesn't include JSO or JFRD, and I won't go there. But that particular board reviews any accident that a city vehicle is involved in. It's a driver's fault, and all the drivers have to be certified, whether they're CDL or not, to operate a city vehicle, and they have to renew those on a periodic basis. And we would look at those. The board is made up of individuals from all different departments of the city, some of them JSO, some of them JFRD. So we had, there's 11 members are on the board, and the city senior safety officer city is the chair of that board. And we would review all of these cases, and there some of the penalties could be they could lose, driver could lose their driving privileges for periods of time, there were quite a number of issues where we had a driver that lost his certification to drive a city vehicle for a year. You know, fortunately, he was able, the department, rather than normally that would cause him to be terminated because he couldn't carry out the duties of his job, the department was able to place him in another position for that period of time where he stayed employed. And then at the end of that one-year period, he had a request to get his certification back. It wasn't automatically granted. So I don't know what the Sheriff's Department has as far as the review. I tried a number of times to get access to those review boards. They do have a review board, they call it. It never was successful. Couldn't get, yes, you can come to this one. I'm hoping now that I can request some of that information. I'll go through Jeff to get some of that information, how the board operates, so I can see what they're actually doing to try to reduce those number of accidents that the city and vehicles are in. And I understand some of those are when they do pit maneuvers, you know, it causes an accident, vehicle damage, and yeah, we did the pit maneuver and that caused the damage. And there's other, when they try to do a blocking of a highway or something in it. And I understand that's part of it. But I'm sorry, but, you know, 480 to 500 accidents a year that's caused by the city, it's just too many as far as I'm concerned. And there's something needs to be in place to make sure that those drivers are properly trained, and if they need to be retrained or whatever, you know, that this needs to be something to hold the driver so he just doesn't crash the vehicle and the next day he gets a new vehicle and goes out. And I mean, I saw it from I was totally involved with it every day, and to see a brand new vehicle, the driver's been in it 2 days and suddenly that $30,000 vehicle is totaled because he wasn't paying attention or whatever. You know, that may be, it's only $30,000 in a $150 million budget. But 10 of those is $300,000, you know. And it's when you're looking at 400 accidents a year at fault accidents, something needs to be done to slow that damage down. So I'm going to try to get some information. I'll go through Jeff to request it from JSO, how they review their accidents, and see if we can come up with something they're doing to reduce that number. And I will be in touch with you about that. Any questions? Okay, that's me.
Thank you so much for doing it. Any other commissioner comments? You guys ready to go? I can see it in your eyes. I appreciate you. All right, so here's my agenda just to make sure I'm all good. All right, the next meeting is November the 4th. If there's no other comments, I'd happily entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right. Seeing no objection, we're adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
That's so intelligible. Is that how they gave it to you?
This is how this is the subrogations. This is how much you got back from it.